So today we come to Daniel chapter 3, which many of you will know as the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. Probably many of us came across this story as a Sunday school story, and it kind of reads like a superhero movie. Now, some of you might have seen Avengers Endgame, but I am sure that there will be more to come. We have not yet seen the end. This story would make a great plot for the next Avengers movie. The good guys always win, and the bad guys always get beaten. And in this story, God is on the side of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and so they win. And the implication is that if God is on our side, we will win as well. But there's a lot more to this story than just that simple kind of the good guys win stuff. Now, I just have to say, today is Mother's Day, and I'm sorry, ladies, but there is not a single female in this story. In fact, this story is soaked in male testosterone and overweening male pride and arrogance. Exactly what you ladies don't like in us men.
That wasn't scripted. But it's true.
So I apologize. I apologize for that right at the beginning. But anyway, on with the story.
You didn't see Avengers Endgame.
I chose not to.
They don't all win, do they? Okay, never mind. So we are going to move on now to the plot of the story. No spoilers. King Nebuchadnezzar is the king of this story, and he is depicted in this picture. And I put this up. I was told to reduce my archaeological slides, so you won't get the full presentation, but isn't it not amazing to you that this was on the Lachish reliefs, 605 to 562 BC, which is when he reigned, and that's actually what he looked like? Because they didn't have cameras, so that's pretty amazing. I mean, no cameras, Bruce, but, you know, this is the next best thing. His conquest of Judah is described in the book of Kings and Jeremiah, and he destroyed Solomon's temple and initiated in the Babylonian captivity, which is what the story of Daniel is set in. He is the king in Daniel's exile, and he has a personality trait that is very common in the Old Testament, and it's called megalomania, which is a characteristic where the person is obsessed with power and control. And the way he exhibits this power and control in his life, and there's other Old Testament figures that do this too, like Herod the Great, is he builds massive structures. So the next picture is going to be what he built. And this is called the Ishtar Gate, and I'm fascinated by archaeology. The Ishtar Gate was built by Nebuchadnezzar, and it's one of the most prominent projects in the ancient Middle East. The entire city was surrounded by a wall structure that looked like this Ishtar Gate. And this gate with the Hanging Gardens of Babylon are considered one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And if you can see the detail in the gate, it shows up better there than back there. I love that he's a detail person. So not. It's a colossal structure forged from exquisite glazed brick. So all that blue is glazed. And then it's ornamented with lapis lazuli and gold. The gate glowed as vibrantly and as powerfully as the sun. And you can imagine this out in the middle of the desert. It was like a glowing structure. The gate is a symbol of both the citizens of Babylonia and the visitors alike, that this is a very important city-state. You know, we are very important. We have this beautiful gate, right? Therefore, it is not hard to think of him building a giant statue in the plain of Dura in the book of Daniel. But we do have modern-day megalomaniacs who have a similar personality to Nebuchadnezzar, and one of those is Donald Trump. Donald Trump has built hundreds of structures around the world, and this is one of his biggest. It's the tallest all-residential tower in the world until 2004. I won't tell you what overtook it. It cost $300 million. To build. It has 58 stories. It consists of a glass exterior. You can see it's astounding. And then it has in the interior, when you walk into it, because we did walk into it, I just wanted to see this megalomaniac structure. It is all marble with gold-plated fittings. I mean, this is like, it's like a modern day Nebuchadnezzar. That's what he was. He is, I mean. Okay, never mind. So moving on. I hope I haven't offended anybody. Okay. Megalomania exposed. So we go to the story of Daniel. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now that is, in our modern day measuring, 30 meters high and 3 meters wide. And Heather, who works in the architecture industry, described to me that is it 3 meters that's about a floor? So this would be about 10 floors high, is what I'm thinking, 10 stories. Is that right?
Something like that.
Okay, detail. By the standards of the day, anyway, it was exceedingly large. We don't know the image was a statue of him, but we think it probably was because of the tie between chapter 2, where Daniel has a dream and the statue has four parts to it. Remember that? And the top is the head of gold, and he's told, that's you. Well, what does he do in chapter 3? He makes a whole statue of him. The logic kind of flows from chapter 2 to chapter 3. But what he doesn't remember from chapter 2, Daniel's dream, is that the statue is actually destroyed in chapter 2. He forgets that little fact because he's a megalomaniac. Right.
So carrying on with the story, we read that he summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. Now, I don't know about you, but I think the author of this story loved lists. I'm a bit of a list person myself. I like to make lists of
things
to do.
Which is one of the differences we had in preparing this sermon.
But anyway, look at this list of people. I mean, you would think it would be enough just to say all the bigwigs got together and came to the dedication of the image. But all these people are spelled out in minute detail. And I think this kind of emphasizes the importance of the occasion. And for Nebuchadnezzar, probably how proud and arrogant he was and how significant it was for him that all the important people in the land came to the dedication of his temple. So I've kind of paraphrased a little bit verse 3, but it just says, so the bigwigs assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. And this list is repeated like 3 or 4 times in this chapter, so it's a very important list in what it says. So King Nebuchadnezzar got all the people together, and then a herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do." So this is how it's going to work. First of all, as soon as you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, there's another one of those lists, then you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Bit of a mouthful, isn't it? Now, this is a pretty impressive list of instruments, and I think really what it's saying is every time you hear the Babylon Philharmonic Orchestra striking up, that's when you're to bow down and worship the image. And notice here, it's not any image, it's the image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. So again, the emphasis is on what King Nebuchadnezzar has done and how important he is.
Megalomania.
And by the way, just a little detail. Just a technical detail, whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. And then in verse 7, we see the list again of all the satraps, but basically it's just saying everybody did as they were told, and everybody was happy, or were they?
So here we have a picture of, as Charles mentioned, the repetition of the lists. This is a picture of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. Sorry, dear. I got to get that detail down. As Charles mentioned, everybody just bows down, and there's kind of a ridiculous air to it, like they aren't really thinking about it. Additionally, there's no hint of hesitation in the text. They don't go, well, should we, shouldn't we, are we going to do this or not? It's like the fear of being burned alive, along with the social pressure of everybody else, just makes them do it. This never happens to us nowadays, though. This mindless bowing highlights the contrast with the steadfastness and the consideration of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They go, wait, hold on, we're not going to do this. Then we read on that the astrologers report the matter to the king in verse 12. But there are some Jews among you who have set over the affairs of the province, who you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These guys are paying no attention to you. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up. Now, there's two parts to this accusation. One, they're not paying attention to the king. They're not doing the mindless bow thing. And number two, they don't want to worship the image. Now, this shouldn't surprise us because we know the backstory. What is the problem here? The problem is that they are being asked to bow down in idolatry, which is one of the Ten Commandments not to do. You know, it's kind of like, did you forget the entire last 2,000 years? The Ten Commandments, Exodus 23, is very clear. Do not take any gods to be alongside of me. Do not make for yourselves gods of gold or silver. That's the very thing Nebuchadnezzar did here.
So this was part of the covenant that God had made with the Israelites, and it was really clear that they were not to worship any image. So what Nebuchadnezzar was asking them to do went right in the face of everything that God had commanded of the Israelites.
And more additionally, this is why they are in Babylon in the first place. God takes them, and Jeremiah is very clear on this. You're going to go to exile in Babylon because you are idol worshipers. That's why you're going there. And so there is no question in their minds that they're going to not do this. They got it. The Babylonian captivity was a terrible, destructive, violent thing where it came in waves and people died and it was horrible. So they're not going to forget that lesson. They're not going to forget it.
But this was not lost on King Nebuchadnezzar. And the story goes on. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of God I have set up?"
Gold.
The image of gold I've set up. So, thank you, hon. Detail. So,
I can do detail, but it's not normal.
So Nebuchadnezzar was furious with rage, and you could understand it. Basically, by not bowing down to the image, they were really saying, we are challenging your authority or your vision of yourself as the most important person in the land. So Nebuchadnezzar decides to give them one last chance. And he says, now when you hear the sound of the, and here's the list again, the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipe, and all kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Now, I think perhaps the reason why Nebuchadnezzar didn't throw these men into the furnace immediately is because they were valuable people to him in his kingdom. And remember, a couple of weeks ago, Andy told us the story about the people that came out of Israel into captivity in Babylon, and some of the best people in the land were handpicked to be trained in the arts and the literature and the study of the...
And they were the handsomest.
Oh, of course.
They were the handsomest people.
And so Nebuchadnezzar knew these people. They were not just the rabble. They were the important people. And so he probably wants to make quite sure that they get a second chance. So he gives them a second opportunity. And he says, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Now, in the original language, it's not just called the blazing furnace. There's actually three words that cluster together in the original language. And literally, it's the furnace of the fire, the one that's blazing. So the idea is this is not just any little fire. This is a really, really serious place. You don't want to go here. But then Nebuchadnezzar says, then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? And I think he's kind of taunting Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. What kind of a God are you worshiping? What kind of God do you think is going to be able to rescue you from my hand and from this furnace of fire, the blazing thing that is going to destroy you? It's a little bit like when the Titanic was built. Some of you might remember the story that when the Titanic was first launched, somebody is reported to have said, even God couldn't sink this boat. And it's kind of like, you challenge God to do something, look out. Because God is not going to have his authority challenged.
So we come now to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's response, which is kind of the high point of the narrative, or the central part of the narrative. It's how they respond to the stress, the trial, that's the most important. They first say, we don't need to defend ourselves to you. Now, I'm not going to go over why that is again, because the reason is King Nebuchadnezzar should know they are not idol worshipers and they will never go there again. That's why they don't need to defend themselves about that. But the Jewish men do refuse to be idolaters because it's one of the Ten Commandments. And in the end, Nebuchadnezzar takes that as a disloyalty. You're not willing to do this and you're not loyal to me, which is not really the issue. Idolatry is the issue to them. Disloyalty is the issue to him. But then verse 17 ends with their very important comment. If we are thrown into the blazing fire, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it. He is able. Nothing is ever impossible with God. Don't forget that, Nebuchadnezzar. Nothing is impossible for our God. And he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. Now, you don't know how that's going to unfold quite yet until we come to the real hinge, which is in verse 18. Even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, they're still respectful, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. We cannot go there again. Now, whether God saves us or not, they say, we will not serve your gods. God calls us to the same standard of loyalty. We might not always get our way. The story might not end the way that we want. There are times in life when we don't get the answers we desire. God's ways are not always our ways, and from our human perspective, God's ways are sometimes hidden.
So I don't think this was the response that Nebuchadnezzar was expecting. I think maybe he thought they would say, oh, King Nebuchadnezzar, we're sorry. We just got a little bit confused. Actually, the orchestra wasn't quite loud enough. If you put a couple more trumpets in your ego orchestra, we probably would have been able to hear a little bit more clearly, and then, of course, we would not have bowed down. But what they heard was not what King Nebuchadnezzar wanted to hear. And so it says, then Nebuchadnezzar was furious. And the idea of fury there is not to be missed, with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it says his attitude toward them changed. Now, when it says his attitude toward them changed, it doesn't really mean attitude. It really means his countenance or the way he appeared. And I don't know if you've ever seen somebody who is absolutely ropeable and livid with anger, but their eyes burn with fire and their whole countenance changes. And I've seen that sometimes when people just get so angry and their face completely changes. That's really the idea behind what this is saying here. So Nebuchadnezzar was so furious that he began to look like a different person. And so he ordered the furnace to be heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. Now, I'm not quite sure in those days how they worked out how hot the fire was going to be, because I don't think they had thermometers like we do today. But possibly this might be sort of a literary device to show that it was as hot as it could possibly go. And so maybe instead of 100 wheelbarrow loads of firewood, Nebuchadnezzar ordered 700 wheelbarrow loads of firewood to go into the furnace to heat it up. The idea here was that this was going to be the most hottest furnace that you could ever possibly imagine. And so from the frying pan, literally into the fire, so these men wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. Now, again, there's a list there. I don't know why all these different clothes things need to be mentioned. It's kind of like saying they went in with their socks and their shoes and their underpants and their pants and their belt and their shirt and their cap and their hat. But anyway, off they went. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of fire killed the soldiers who took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to these three men firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Now, the furnace would probably have been a pit in the ground, and so that's why they talk about them falling into the fire. And you could imagine the men that were sort of shushing them into the fire got close to the edge, and as the flames leapt up, they would have consumed them. So from a purely human perspective, there is no way these men were going to survive in the furnace. And so you would expect that within seconds, they would have been snuffed out and been burned to death.
So this next slide it's a little bit funny, although it may not be funny to you, so we'll see. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, wait, weren't there just three men? And I'm thinking, you're kidding, right? You've gone through this whole thing with the orchestra and the lists and all that, and you don't know how many men you threw into the fire? Weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire? And his people go, yes, certainly, Your Majesty. Look, four men are rocking around in the fire, he says, unbound and unharmed. And the fourth looks like a son of the gods. Now, verse 24, where it says, his feet in amazement, he leapt to his feet in amazement, that word actually means more like trepidation. So there's a whiff of fear to it. He's kind of like, wait, did I get this wrong? When I taunted their God in verse 15 and said, what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? Is there another one? Could I have possibly screwed this up? He's just a little bit kind of like, don't know if I got that quite right.
It must have been pretty unsettling for him, I think.
Yeah.
Because you can imagine.
He's a megalomaniac. Did I mention that?
All his plans, the best laid plans of mice and men and King Nebuchadnezzar's actually proved to be not quite what he expected.
Yes, and there's men who have that same personality, so we know what it's like today. Then verse 26, Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, now he's calling them that, come out, come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them, and they saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their heads singed, their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on their underwear.
So this is not what Nebuchadnezzar had planned. It's not what he hoped would happen, and it was probably very unsettling for him. So obviously a miracle took place here. In order for these men to have been saved in the fiery furnace, God had to do something special, and he did. Now, we're going to develop this idea a little bit more in a few moments, but we sometimes go through fiery furnace experiences in life. Life is not always just plain sailing, and sometimes we find ourselves in the midst of experiences that might feel like a fiery furnace. And sometimes we come out the other side, and we're okay. Our hair is not singed and there is no smell of smoke on our bodies or on our clothes. But sometimes we might get more than singed. Sometimes there might be a bit of a burn here and there. And, you know, sometimes it might even feel as if in the midst of those fiery furnace experiences, we are actually being consumed.
And I actually felt like Julie, I don't know where she's gone, who shared her testimony with Jan. She was singed. I mean, sometimes we walk away from things in our life and we're not the same. We're hurt.
But the important point, which we'll develop again in a minute, is that in the midst of the fiery furnace, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not alone. God was with them. And that's the important, or one of the important lessons that we learned from the story. So what they found, of course, was that being through the fiery furnace and in the midst of that fiery furnace experience, for them, it wasn't the end of the story. It wasn't the end of the road. There was more beyond the fiery furnace. So we find actually that there are two miracles in this story. So, whoops, I think I've gone too far there. Here we go. So there's two miracles in the story. The first miracle is that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not burned in the furnace. But the second miracle is a change that takes place in the heart of Nebuchadnezzar. So look at what the story says. Then Nebuchadnezzar says, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. So one minute we have Nebuchadnezzar full of his own importance, stroking his ego and basically telling himself and everybody else that there is no greater power, there is no one greater than he is. But now in this verse, we find him worshipping a God who is greater than he. And so his own importance and his own arrogance has been humbled by God. And so the second miracle in the story is the way in which God worked in his life. And when God works in our lives, the same miracle takes place. All of us have to come to that point of acknowledging our own need of a Savior. And that's a humbling experience for many of us. But when God works that miracle in our lives, it's a wonderful thing. So we end up here that God, Nebuchadnezzar is worshipping the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he says, therefore I decree that people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and here this scissors come in, be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way. So rather than taunting God and saying, what's this God that's going to be able to save you? Now he is actually legislating that anybody who doesn't worship this God will be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into a pile of rubble. Now, if you were here last week, you might remember hearing in the story that anybody who didn't, the magicians, if they weren't able to interpret the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, this very same punishment was going to be meted out to them. So maybe Nebuchadnezzar had kind of a list of punishments, and this was one of the big ones, and here it crops up again. They'll be cut into pieces, and their houses will be turned into...
Fiery furnace, the lion's den, got all these things.
Yeah. Anyway, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's actions and dedication to God have the effect of displaying God's power in such a way that it silences all those who are opposed to God. And so we come to the end of the story. All's well that ends well. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So I guess the question for us is, what lessons then can we learn from this story? Well, I think there are a couple of really significant lessons. Firstly, we are not alone in the fiery furnaces of life. We are all subject at times to fiery furnace experiences. And I don't know what they are for you. We've heard some stories this morning that tell us what some people's fiery furnace experiences have been like. For some of us, they might be relational struggles that we have, maybe tensions within our family. For some of us, they might be struggles of finances, maybe trying to find a job, unemployment. They can be all kinds of different things. And many of us go through different fiery furnace experiences. But part of being human is that life has its challenges and its complexities. And none of us completely escape those. So we are all subject to the fires of life. But...
And secondly, God is often most real in the midst of the fire. They didn't see the fourth person until they were in the fire. And Nebuchadnezzar couldn't see the fourth person either. So sometimes people watching us can only see God's work when we're in the worst time in our lives. And I'm looking across the room, I don't know of a person in here that's had no fiery furnaces. We've all had those. And some of you are in those right now. Look for God. Ask him to show himself to you. He's there. And I think sometimes the prosperity gospel has taught us to try to leap from that. You know, let's just try to get out of the furnace. Sometimes God wants us to pray that he'll show himself to us in the furnace. Because only when we're in the furnace and we walk through it is our faith deepened, our character strengthened, and God's love for us is proven to us so that we come forth as gold.
So the second point is that God asks us to trust him, whatever the outcome. God is with us in the midst of our trials, but we might not escape the trial. And, you know, I guess for some of us, we do have difficult times, and we do come out the other side, and we escape relatively unscathed, or relatively unsinged, or unburnt, or whatever the image might be. But, you know, sometimes we do go through trials and we really do experience the full force of the flames in our lives. And that can be all kinds of different things. But just like, as we said before, with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, God is with us in the midst of the fires of life. I'd just like to share a story that has been quite real to us recently. So some of you may remember Malcolm and Claire Donald and their family, who used to be part of this church. And they were part of our home group. So there's Gwen and I go to a home group with some of you here. And we really grew to love them. And they were a special couple, and we grew to love their children. And they journeyed with us for the several years that they were here at TBC. But about 8 months ago, Malcolm was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And nobody wants to be diagnosed with a brain tumor because there's always a risk that it will end up being fatal. And in Malcolm's case, it was. He fought it for a number of months, but eventually the brain tumor dominated and took over. And just a few weeks ago, some of us here went to his funeral. And it was a very sad time, but it was also a very joyful time. The testimony of Claire, Malcolm's wife, and the children was that in the midst of that difficult, difficult time, Malcolm had a really real experience of God's presence with them in the midst of that difficulty. And it was actually quite a wonderful testimony at the funeral to hear the story of how in the midst of those difficult times and that fiery experience, Malcolm was so aware of God's presence with him. And it was just really humbling to hear how he had responded and how he had walked with God in the midst of that very, very difficult time. And I think Paul kind of hints at that in a verse that I really find a very helpful verse. Romans chapter 8 and verse 18. Oh, sorry, I haven't got it on the screen here. But Romans chapter 8, verse 18, Paul says, "I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us." And what he's saying is that as we go through life, we do go through fiery experiences. We do go through the furnace. And sometimes we come out perhaps relatively unscathed, but sometimes we are even consumed by the furnace. But, you know, the important thing is that the furnace is not the end of the journey, because there is going to be a reality for all of us beyond the grave that we will experience things that are not even worth comparing with the suffering that we experience in this life.
And then the second point, and we're just going to land on this for a minute, is the verse 318, which is the hinge of the chapter, even if he does not. Now, I want to just move to the next slide, dear. I'd like for you to think of all of Scripture as a lake. And you're skipping a rock across the lake. And there's a theme that every time that rock hits the lake, that theme comes out in Scripture. Okay? So the theme is, if he does not save me from the furnace. I'm going to walk you through the skips. If he does not from the furnace. Job 13, 15 to 16. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. This will turn out for my deliverance. Daniel 3:18, where we're sitting today. Even if God does not save us, we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Luke 22:42, Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, Jesus says in the Garden of Gethsemane. Yet not my will, but yours be done. Jesus was our example. He walked through the fiery furnace.
In the book of Hebrews, we find a similar theme. This is the hall of fame, if you like, of the biblical narrative. We read of believers who faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning, they were sawed in two, they were killed by the sword, yet none of them received what had been promised, since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. And the important thing in this verse is that some of them did come through the fiery furnace, they faced jeers and flogging, but they came out the other side with their skin. But others were put to death by stoning, they were sawed in two. The mind boggles. Can you imagine being cut in half? Probably not put to death before that happens. Doesn't even bear thinking about. And yet none of those people received what they promised. So those experiences were not the end of the road. Some of these people made the ultimate sacrifice in this life, but they would be made perfect in the life to come.
And I think the final skip of the rock is in Philippians 3, 8 to 11, where Paul says, I count all things to be loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and count them but rubbish in order that I may gain Christ and may be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own derived from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness which comes from God on the basis of faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering, being conformed to his death, in order that I may attain to the resurrection from the dead. So there's some way in which all of the people who suffered before us combined their suffering with Jesus' suffering, combines with all of the Hebrews 11 people, combines with us, and we are all heroes of the faith. And that's really something. Okay, I'm gonna cry. You better go, dear.
So this is such a powerful concept here. So I don't know what your fiery furnace might be, but it might be even if God doesn't save my marriage, or even if he doesn't heal my child, even if he doesn't provide me with a new job, even if he doesn't save me from bankruptcy court, even if he doesn't give me a relationship with my estranged father or mother or child, whatever it might be, even if he doesn't rescue my spouse from addiction, I don't know what your even if might be, but it could be that something in your life is a hinge point like it was in this story. Even if God doesn't save us, we will not bow down and serve the image of gold that you have set up, King Nebuchadnezzar. So whatever your even if might be, God is calling us to remain faithful to him. And just like God was with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the midst of that furnace, God will always be with us in the midst of the trial. The flames might lick at us, they may even consume us in this life, but ultimately, we will be victors, we will be heroes of the faith because God will be with us.